This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. It is an American tragedy. Where the twin towers of the World Trade Center once stood proud and tall, there is now an abyss of horror and heartache. And from the ashes rises a new challenge for New York and the nation. What kind of permanent memorial should be built to honor the victims of 9/11? There are many views and no easy answers in this hour, getting to the heart of this emotional debate. But first, earlier I spoke with Dan Barry. He's a reporter for the New York Times covering the September 11th tragedy. Today he attended another firefighter funeral, and I asked him about the seemingly endless cycle of tears in New York.
It does, because I think the one I attended this morning, it was actually one of two, and there's another service tonight. I think the one I attended was the 295th or 296th since the disaster. Wow. But that's just firefighters.
And still with all the passion and emotion of the first ones?
Yes, there's a certain routine settling on the process, on the grieving, you know, because you're seeing the same people over and over again, the same officials. They can only say the same things so many times. There's always an effort to make each service individual, you know, to remember the personal life as well as the overall sacrifice.
What's determining the schedule of these funerals? Is it just waiting in line for a church to open up, or how do they decide when to have a particular funeral?
It's absolutely at the call of the family. And so there are some 30-odd families who have not made any arrangements whatsoever, and no one is pressuring them to do so. It's really when the family feels ready. Of course, what's complicating matters even further is that for the great preponderance of the firefighters, there are no remains. And so some families, when they get the remains, okay, now they're set, they feel they can have a funeral. Other families, it's open-ended in a weird way. And so after a while, they decide, well, let's have a service.
Dan, for those of us outside New York, it's difficult to visualize, to imagine what the disaster site looks like today. Set that scene for us. What's it look like and what's going on there now?
Well, it's changed. There have been deep changes in the way the site has looked from the first days. Everyone knows by now that it was compared to a ring of hell. It was smoke. It was dangling steel and fire and such. Now it's a kind of a weird little village where the roads cleared away, but at the center of it, it's still smoldering. It's still smoking, so it still has that eerie feel to it. It's still a very, very moving sight now.
Presumably by this point, thousands of truckloads of debris have been taken away.
That's right.
And are they still examining every square foot and yard of debris for human remains?
Yes, they are. And actually, there's a kind of a two-pronged examination. One at the site, so as the material is being taken out of the site, there are firefighters and others examining the stuff as it's being carted off for anything, whether it's human remains or some kind of item that could help identify somebody, say a helmet or a piece of clothing. Mm-hmm. So that's happening at the site. Then the stuff is being brought to the closed landfill called Freshkills in Staten Island, and there the stuff is actually laid out in rows and rows, and like almost like half of a football field, and then police officers and law enforcement officials in protective suits go over the stuff with rakes and shovels and examine it once again. In fact, it's examined as it's coming down off the truck as well.
So much of the focus has been on the loss of firemen, and of course it was a terrible loss. But relatives of thousands of civilian survivors are speaking out too, and they're not all happy, I guess. What are they saying?
Well, I think everybody wants to have respect for the loss of others. It's not to suggest that there's a pitting between two groups necessarily. But because the firefighters and the police officers and some officers from the Port Authority died, in a sense, in the service of the city and in the service of the public, they do get a lot of attention from the city, say from Mayor Giuliani and the governor and what have you. But 10 times more people were lost who were heroes in their own right simply because they went to work, they were supporting families, they were doing what we all do. So the survivors of those people, the so-called civilians, feel sometimes a little left out, not only in the attention being given to the loss of life, but also in how information is being disseminated and access to the site.
Dan, what proposals for memorials have you been hearing? Are there some being floated already?
There have been, but there's not been any kind of great collection of ideas and any group that's examining them yet. I do know that the survivors of the firefighters and the survivors of the civilians want to make sure that they have a say in whatever happens down at the disaster site. It's about a 16-acre swath on the lower end of Manhattan. And there's a fear on their part that somehow, whatever memorial, there has to be some kind of memorial. I don't think anyone is disputing that. But the families feel that, you know, we worry when there's a lot of money and there's a lot of real estate going on, and as time passes, that whatever memorial is erected, it won't be befitting the loss of 4,000 or 5,000 lives.
And is there a sense so far that the relatives of survivors will be brought in on the conversation about what takes place there?
I think that there is. You know, there's really no august and appointed body as yet focusing on that part. I think, you know, everyone is trying first to clear it up, and they're still burying and honoring the dead. But I think that they will have a seat at that table. No one wants to face a picket line of firefighters' widows saying you're not remembering our husbands and loved ones properly. And so my understanding is that they will have a great say in that.
Dan Barry is a reporter with the New York Times. He spoke to us from New York. America knows and honors its hallowed places like Gettysburg, Pearl Harbor, Oklahoma City. People gather at memorials to remember, to reflect, and vow never to forget. How will America remember and honor the dead of September 11th? Our guest tonight says we need a memorial at Ground Zero. That place profaned by terror, he says, has been made sacred by death. And we all understand that. But what kind of memorial do you think should be built to honor the victims of 9/11? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio is Stephen Prothro. He's Associate Professor of Religion at Boston University and has studied American death rituals. He's the author of Purified by Fire, A History of Cremation in America. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Prothro.
Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you. You've looked at death and remembrance in America, Stephen Prothro. What are the special challenges here in the case of remembering and honoring the dead of September 11th?
Well, I think there's a number of challenges. Back in the colonial period in New England and before the United States was even founded, we had a lot more homogeneity in terms of the society. Mm-hmm. And basically every burial, every remembrance of an individual was really quite the same. And we have a very different society now, and the trend in death rituals has been towards customization, where the particular life can be remembered in a very particular way. It might be a young Hindu girl who loved to play with, you know, a given kind of toy who's being remembered, or it might be an elderly Orthodox Jewish man who wants a particular type of burial. Mm-hmm. And here we have not just one person, but many, many people, and we're going to have some kind of memorial that somehow needs to speak about the individuals and yet needs to speak in a way that is respectful of the differences of these folks who died there, who were Christians, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, young and old.
We've heard a lot in the wake of September 11th about the diversity of people in the towers in New York, not to mention the people who went down on the plane to Pennsylvania and the people at the Pentagon. And, of course, our society celebrates diversity. At the same time, we've heard a lot about the unity of spirit, of emotion that's come out of September 11th. Does that suggest that we can transcend somehow and honor all those diverse dead with a single monument, a memorial? In some sense, we'll have to, won't we?
I think that's right. And we have some examples of how to do this. Clearly, with the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, for example, we have a way that we remember the unity of all these people who died, who are all somehow expressed against this black granite slab that's carved out of the earth, and yet we have the names there as well. And so you have the sort of one in the many there. And I'm sure we'll come up with something like that for Ground Zero as well.
We're going to talk later with the executive director of the memorial in Oklahoma City. But what about the challenge of building a memorial that is in some ways unlike our war memorials, because this is not an event that we can celebrate in any sense? Our Vietnam memorial goes a long way towards saying this is a war we were deeply ambivalent about, but here was something that was just simply tragic and an affront. The architect's challenge there is going to be a huge one, isn't it?
That's right. And I think any memorial that you build, whether it's an individual tombstone for a particular person or whether it's a memorial to a nation like we have all over Washington, D.C., is always a statement about – it's always a statement about history and about what we think about a particular event or a particular time. And I think the debate that we are going to have, and we're even starting to have now, is a debate about what this event really was about. Was it about the coming together of the nation? Was it about a temporary eruption of terrorism into a country that stands for freedom and democracy? Was it well, what was it? And I think that's a large part of the debate.
But you know the personal and the family issues that arise at the point of death. And as you point out, here we have more than 4,000 individuals and individual families whose emotions and need to remember and honor come into play here. I guess you've written about this tension in American history between honoring the remains of the dead, that is the physical remains, and honoring the spirit of those who lived. In this case, the remains are largely absent.
That's right. And I think that's something that hasn't been sufficiently noted. I mean, I've just finished a book on cremation in the history of the United States. And one of the first things that I thought as I saw those buildings going up in flames was that this was a massive cremation. And it's not something that is being said so much because it is gruesome really to think about. But the temperature that was reached through that fuel oil in the World Trade Center towers is the same temperature that's used in crematories. And so, you know, my first thought was this was a massive cremation. And I think that the memorial needs to somehow attend to that as well as attending to this as a kind of burial. We have a debate in the culture right now between cremation and burial. And there are people who see burial as really the way to go when it comes to a dead body. And there's other people who see cremation as the way to go. And in this circumstance, I think we need to attend to both. But cremation in general tends to work better with the notion of the spirit and honoring the spirit of the person. Mm. And I think burial is a type of disposal of the dead, disposition of the dead, that attends to the fact that the body is somehow sacred. And people who are having such a hard time now, as we heard in the piece earlier, mm-hmm. with the absence of the body, mm-hmm. that's very difficult for people who come from a tradition where you remember the dead in part by showing reverence for their actual physical remains.
There's this issue of the ambiguous loss here. And some of the 30 families that Dan Barry pointed out still haven't had funerals are perhaps still not willing to accept even the fact of the death, let alone move on to the discussion of a memorial. Yet as a nation, we're pouring so much attention and focus into this that soon that begins to have a need to take expression in some kind of memorial. Certainly completely untraditional. There's no precedent for this amount of loss of life in this short time inside our borders, the United States, obviously.
Right. I think that's right. I think that's right. And I think this challenge of the burial cremation question is something that I would, for example, like to see some recognition of both of those elements in this type of memorial. There was a big debate at the Oklahoma Memorial, as I recall, about whether to bury remains, body parts that were found that were never identified. And there were people who really wanted those buried there, and there were people who really didn't because they didn't want the site to be a cemetery site. Mm. And I think in this case, there's going to be a similar debate. You know, what are you going to do with all those small pieces of body that are never identified with a particular person and yet we know are human remains? Are those going to be buried there along with these ashes that have been strewn all over lower Manhattan? What is the negotiation there that's going to happen?
As complex as Vietnam was, this is really more complex. It's not just a memorial. It is a burial site or the site where whatever remains remain, have their last earthly presence. We're talking about what kind of memorial should, can, will be built to honor the dead of September 11th. We're talking about Manhattan, but it really extends beyond that to Washington and Pennsylvania as well. What will serve to honor them appropriately? What will serve to bind the nation's wound as we look at this need to remember and honor? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about what kind of memorial will rise ultimately to remember and honor the dead of September 11th. We're joined in the studio by Stephen Prothro. He's professor of religion at Boston University and a student of American death rituals. What kind of memorial will be fitting to mark the 9/11 tragedy? What kind of structure of symbol would honor the dead and our national understanding of this disaster? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now by Kerry Watkins. Kerry is executive director of the Oklahoma City Memorial. Welcome, Kerry Watkins.
Hi. Good evening.
Thanks very much for joining us tonight.
I'm honored to be here.
Kerry Watkins, Oklahoma City sadly may have the closest parallel to what we're now or will soon struggle with in New York and Washington and Pennsylvania. That is a lot of sadness and a lot of death, not out of something with really any glorious element to it, but out of something that's pretty purely sad and tragic. What's your thinking? How do we memorialize the people who lost their lives here without somehow memorializing the event?
I think that there's a real fine line you walk there. We worked very hard to do two things. One, to remember, and secondly, to educate.
Mm-hmm.
And not to honor the terrorist attack or the perpetrators of the attack, but to honor those people who lost their lives so innocently in Oklahoma City on April 19th, 1995.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's the same challenge in whatever memorial is constructed. It will be the process that we went through here was a very inclusive, time-consuming process that was not done by just the architects or the artist, but by the community.
What did you learn from that process, Kerry Watkins, that might help inform the work of New Yorkers and others to come to a consensus on a good memorial?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things. One is, you know, choosing to build a memorial is the hardest thing a community can do. It is not the easy way out. In many ways, rebuilding the buildings as they stood before in some fashion is much easier to do because you can get the plans and build and move on.
Oh, so you're saying that there'll be some view that says, well, let's not cover this with a memorial. Let's put buildings back up and live.
I mean, I've already heard that out of the mayor's office and many other places. But
well, it's 16 acres. It's too much for one memorial, perhaps.
Right. And it's, you know, we're talking about three times the size of the acres of land that we have here. But but I think you know, you have to make the choice if you're going to build a memorial or if you're going to rebuild or if you're going to do a combination of both. And I think, you know, all those are valid options and the community needs to decide. And those who lost loved ones or walked out of that building and survived and today live with the enormous survivor's guilt should have an opportunity to voice their opinion. And we did that here.
It's a
tiring process. It takes an enormous amount of time and patience and effort on the part of every politician and every person who lost a loved one. It's not just, you know, it doesn't just satisfy one faction or the other. You've got to bring every kind of person together, every stereotype, every socioeconomic type, and decide that you're going to agree to disagree, and you're going to come to consensus in some form or fashion of what will be built on that site.
For those of us who haven't seen it, could you describe what you've done in Oklahoma City?
Sure. Our memorial is three components. It is an outdoor symbolic memorial, which sits on 3.5 acres, a 30,000-square-foot museum, which is the educational component, and then there's the Institute for the Prevention of Terrorism, which is a public policy-making body that grants research money to work on prevention of terrorism and first responders information. So we have three very different parts.
I think the outdoor part, some of us may have seen on television at least, the empty chairs.
Right. It's 3 acres, and there's 168 empty chairs, glass-based, bronze-backed chairs that's set between two four-story gates, 901, which represents the moment before the bombing in Oklahoma City, and 903 is the moment after, where healing begins. And between those two gates is a 350-foot reflecting pool, which is about three-quarters inch deep.
Kerry Watkins, what about the educational portion? What's the message that you're trying to convey in that 30,000-square-foot facility?
Two things. One is we're trying to tell the story, the facts.
Mm-hmm.
This outdoor is a symbolic site, and it's educational also, but indoors is purely educational, purely informational, telling the facts of the story. We talk about the perpetrators there. You see their pictures, but we don't glorify them. But mm-hmm. they are part of the story that we have to tell about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we are trying to teach people that it could happen, A, anywhere, B, they can make a difference in their community, their church, their synagogue, their neighborhood. They can make a difference by their attitude, their
mm-hmm.
actions, their choices. And then thirdly, I think we are trying to convey a message of hope, that even in the worst of times, something good can happen, and something good can come out of what happened in New York City.
Steve Prothero here in the studio, a thought?
Yeah, I think one observation I have about both the case in New York and also with Oklahoma City and even in Washington and Pennsylvania is that the memorial process has already started. It starts the day that,
That's right.
that these events happen. And so you had this spontaneous memorializing that we saw in Oklahoma City. And similarly in New York City with these Xerox sheets of the lives of people.
Sure.
I think in the piece you quoted, I call those paper headstones, that these are ways that mobily people can go around and start memorializing their loved ones. And so the memorialization process isn't sort of off in the future. It's already begun. It's already happening.
Kerry Watkins,
right.
did you see?
It started here immediately, and it's a process that we just built on over time.
Mm-hmm.
The final design you see in Oklahoma City did not originally include the fence, which was the temporary memorial here.
Mm-hmm.
And because at the time we commenced this international design competition, the fence was just a fence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it began to grow over time.
It took on its own meaning.
And today it still is very powerful. And so we went back to the designers and asked them if there was a way they could include it. They came up with a very significant way to include it along the 903 wall, which is the kind of the side of the memorial which represents healing. And it's still used today by people to leave items of all kinds of expression of hope and sadness and anything they can do to people, either name tags, their car tags, anything they can do. It's much like the Vietnam Wall.
So still interactive there. Kerry Watkins, thanks so much for joining us this evening.
Thanks.
Kerry Watkins is executive director of the Oklahoma City Memorial. We have an enormous number of callers who want to join this conversation. We're talking about what would be a fitting memorial to honor the dead of September 11th. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Paul is on the line. Welcome, Paul.
Good evening.
Hi.
My thoughts are threefold.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it would be my hope that both the Ground Zero site, the Pentagon, and the cornfield in Pittsburgh would be designed as one memorial.
So somehow linked in their design.
Correct. And even if there is an electronic link, so if a person is at one site, they can try and understand the other two sites.
That would be very 21st century.
The second element is, I think, it's critical to have at one of the sites, if you will, a sanctuary, and I truly mean a non-sectarian sanctuary, so that people who want to reflect or grieve or pray have an opportunity to do that. And the third element would be what I will call a museum, so that people can try and get an understanding of what has happened and learn from what has happened, if one is able to understand it.
Mm.
I still don't.
It's a tough one for everyone to get their heads around. Paul, thank you very much for your call. Steve Prothero, Paul, and Kerry Watkins in Oklahoma City before that both suggested a multifaceted memorial, that it won't be enough here perhaps just to have a single symbol, that education is part of it. In this case, perhaps even linking the three sites. Is there precedent for that?
I think that's one of the challenges of this case, where you do have the three the three sites, and the idea of linking them together electronically is a terrific idea. I hadn't thought of that, and it's a wonderful idea. The notion of a sanctuary is particularly intriguing. I, as a professor of religion, I noticed that as soon as these tragedies got on the television on 911, we immediately had clerics who were being called in by CNN and others to talk, and it was as if the culture realized immediately that this was a religious event of some sort that called for some kind of theological response. And I think people didn't really know what to say about it theologically, mm-hmm. and nobody really does, even clerics. But this Paul's suggestion of some sort of non-sectarian sanctuary is an intriguing one, and I think that would speak to the fact that many Americans do see this as a profoundly religious event, however horrific it is.
This is all going to get very interesting as it intersects with the financial and urban planning aspects of Lower Manhattan, at least. Larry Silverstein just bought a 99-year lease for the Twin Towers last summer, and a significant percentage of New York office space was here, and now it's also, as you say, a sacred place, a brand-new challenge trying to make these things tie together.
That's right, and there's no way this site is going to be a memorial, the entire acreage there. That's inconceivable to me that would occur. But at the same time, it's inconceivable to me that none of it would be devoted to memorializing the event. The idea that this would somehow just go away and we would go back to our lives and pretend it didn't happen, I think, is beyond imagining.
We're talking about a potential memorial, a future memorial for the dead of September 11th. How should we memorialize the vast diversity and number of people who died? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Donna is on the line. Hi, Donna.
Hi, how are you tonight?
We're well, thanks.
Okay, here we go. I lived in New York while mm-hmm. the Trade Towers were built.
Mm-hmm.
And I've already written to Larry with an idea, and here it is, because I know, you know, it couldn't just not be buildings.
Mm-hmm.
I suggested 4 50-story buildings, each one a quarter of a circle,
okay.
in a thin quarter of a circle. So if a bird were looking down on it, a bird would see almost a complete circle, but mm-hmm. there would be openings between the four.
Mm-hmm.
And in the interior of the four, inside that circle, would be, I think, a sacred garden, an exquisite garden, a really well thought out, carefully created garden, trees to shade people, maybe a canopy, maybe it could almost feel as if one were inside a building, but it's trees instead, but just a gorgeous, gorgeous garden.
Mm.
And the exterior walls of the inside of the four buildings, as you are in this garden looking mm-hmm. at that building, there would be 4,300, 5,600, 6,200, whatever the mm-hmm. number of ultimately, the ultimate number of those who were gone in the tragedy, the unspeakable tragedy that mm-hmm. we're still trying to speak about. And each one would be named on a tile.
Donna, I have to ask you, you've imagined this so specifically. Are you an architect?
No, art's my background, and I have a store now, so it's just a creative store.
Mm-hmm.
But each tile would be, I envision, designed by children, colorful tiles, but an adult would do the name of each person, so the name is very clear.
Donna, thanks so much for calling. You've painted a word picture that I think we can all see. Steve Prothero, I'm struck by the specificity of this single act of imagination on Donna's part, and I'm imagining that across the country, millions of people are building some mental image of what might serve as an appropriate memorial.
That's right. I've already heard many of these ideas. One was floated quite early on about projecting massive 110-story high beams of light that would stand at night as virtual reminders of the towers. I've heard proposals that there ought to be a bush or a tree for each person that would show his or her particular identity, and that would be the way to do it. I think that these kinds of tragedies call out to all of us the sorts of memories that we have about the death of loved ones, that and our creativity as well. And we see that here with this call.
Mm. I want to reach out now and bring in a very special guest. We're joined by Marian Fontana. Her husband, a New York City firefighter, is among the missing at the disaster site, and she's been active with a new group called the 9/11 Widows and Victims Families Association. Welcome, Marian Fontana.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for joining us. We're honored that you're with us, and you know, we're trying to think tonight about what ultimately will be an appropriate memorial in Lower Manhattan, as well as in Washington and Pennsylvania. Is your group focused on this at all yet, or are you still fully in the mindset of searching and retrieving the remains of the people who died on September 11th?
Well, we are fully absorbed with getting dignified recovery for our loved ones. And it's hard to even hear of ideas right now, although people have had some very interesting ones. And I certainly think at some point we would like to be involved in the decision-making process when that does happen. But right now there have been so many issues of retrieval that we haven't even had a chance to do that.
The retrieval itself is, in a way, part of the process of honoring those who died on the 11th. Are you satisfied with the way that's being carried out, Marian Fontana?
Well, I'm pleased with the fact that the mayor really listened to us and did make changes by adding more firemen. The firemen in particular are very reverent and handle the retrieval effort in a very dignified way. Mm-hmm. We were worried that it would become a construction zone, which is what it became for a little while. Mm-hmm. Now we're kind of dealing with the fresh kills dump, where a lot of parts and bodies are being found. And so we're trying to handle that as well. But as far as the site goes, right now it's being handled pretty well, and we're staying very vigilant and making sure that it continues to be that way until everything is done.
Marian, your loss in this event is one that humbles all of us, and we are, you know, tread very carefully and respectfully here, but I wonder, when a memorial ultimately grows in Lower Manhattan, and of course it will, do you look forward to that as a personal memorial or as a national memorial? What do you hope or expect that will mean for you and your family?
Well, I'm still grieving, so I think part of the grieving process is it's very hard to look into the future at all, really. And I think we're all having trouble doing that, even just getting, you know, doing the day-to-day. I mean, it's interesting to hear. I know there's a lot of architecture firms submitting plans and who are sending them here to us so that we can see them, and I'm very touched that people, you know, from the beginning have all over the country have been reaching out and trying to, you know, honor the fallen in some really nice ways. So I am touched by that, but it is hard to even imagine anything being there. Although I think, you know, of course, at some point we will have to address that, and I know a lot of our members feel like they want to be a big part of that.
Marian Fontana, we remember your husband, David, and we thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
We're talking about what memorial will ultimately grow to honor those who died on September 11th. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about what kind of memorial will, should eventually grow to honor the victims of the September 11th terrorist attack. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. What kind of structure, what kind of symbol would honor the dead and our national understanding of this disaster? We're joined in studio tonight by Stephen Prothero. He's a professor of religion at Boston University. And Stephen, just before the break, we heard from Marian Fontana, whose husband, David, was a New York City firefighter, and of course, among the missing, presumed dead now at the disaster site. She was president of the 9/11 Widows and Victims Families Association, and you speak with someone who's taking the loss so directly, and it really brings us out of the conceptual level and down to the reality. It's both a national and an individual tragedy. Talk to us for a second about how this memorial may fall in the range of American monuments memorials are out there. It's a unique and awful event, yet we've lost huge numbers of Americans in other events that are marked by memorials and monuments. How must this one be like or different from those?
Well, I do think it's a national memorial that we're contemplating, and that's where I think the notion of somehow tying together the D.C., the Pennsylvania, and the New York City sites really makes a lot of sense, that this is not a local event. I think that the Oklahoma City event was national as well because it was televised, but this was national in a different sort of way. It's also, it should be said, an international tragedy. There have been some critics who have spoken about the way in which this has been interpreted maybe in too nationalistic a way, that the response has been a little too much flag waving and not quite enough recognition that this was a sort of attack on the world. There were people from all over the world who died who were not just U.S. nationals. And so we have this issue of multiple religious affiliations for people who died, but also multiple nationalities.
But what can we learn from Gettysburg, from Pearl Harbor, from Oklahoma City?
Well, I don't know. I think we can learn. I think what we do learn from those is that all of those were contested when they were done. And what finally emerges out of the contest is some sort of consensus about what the event was about. Mm-hmm. And another thing that emerges is who gets to decide. I mean, one issue with the Oklahoma situation was there were design firms who came in with these terrific ideas, but those ideas were eventually vetoed by a lot of the participants, and finally that was really a grassroots sort of effort. Mm-hmm. And I think one question here is going to be, to what extent do architects really define this? To what extent do the people in New York define it? And to what extent is it really a national, international conversation?
Let's turn here once more from the people before our time runs out tonight. We're talking about a memorial for September 11th. Jade is on the line. Welcome, Jade.
Hi, how you doing?
We're well, thank you.
Hi.
Good. I just wanted to let you know about some smaller-scale memorials that are happening. Mm-hmm. I've started a grassroots collaborative memorial. It has about 150 artists involved. Mm-hmm. Well, we need some more artists, actually. but it's a 5-by-6-foot piece that's composed of 1-by-1-inch squares, each with a face in it, so that somebody standing in front of this piece of artwork will be able to look at it and get a sense of what the number of people lost actually is.
And this is not intended to go to New York or Washington, but this will stay wherever you are, Jade.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be showing it locally, and I'd hope to.
Is that where is it exactly?
I'm in Somerville,
near Boston.
In Boston.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I was hoping to put it in a storefront window, perhaps facing out, so that it could reach as broad a cross-section of people mm-hmm, as possible. Mm-hmm. And it's nice because the people who are involved get a lot out of it, too.
Just by being involved and helping create it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have everybody from, you know, clothing designers to professional artists to kindergarten classes who've been doing it. And we're actually looking for more people if anybody out there wants to join in.
All right, Jade. We'll make a note on our website. Thanks very much for calling.
And you know, this is something that happens again with other kinds of deaths and other kinds of memorials. It's not that there won't be one memorial. We already have in Boston a memorial that went up with the names of people who died on September 11th who lived in the Boston area. We already have one.
Mm-hmm.
So this is
the
this
creation is spontaneous.
Well,
in many ways.
It's spontaneous, and it's done by. By governments, in the case of the Boston one, it's also done by people like Jade, and it's done by spontaneously in Union Square in New York City, and by all sorts of people. So this issue of the memorial, I think it should be understood, is broader than a particular piece of art that might be produced by an architect at Ground Zero.
We can hope that gets harnessed. The energy and the passion there gets harnessed. We had an email earlier saying the memorial should be a rebuilt replicas of the giant Buddhas of Bamiyan that were destroyed in Afghanistan. So people's imaginations are working in many directions tonight, and and all through this season. Steve Prothero, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you for having me.
Steve Prothero is professor of religion at Boston University. He studies American death rituals. He's the author of Purified by Fire, A History of Cremation in America. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Since September 11th, musicians in all genres have had to decide how they would respond in performance to terror. President Bush asked the nation to resume a sort of normalcy, but music directors had to decide whether to stick to original programs or to drop pieces no longer appropriate and add music that was more uplifting, reflective, or hopeful. Such a decision was required of music director Tom Hall and his Baltimore Choral Arts Society. Their season opening concert was originally keyed to the St. Cecilia holiday with works of Handel and Benjamin Britten. But after September 11th, he felt compelled to respond and change.
The program A Choral Tribute, Musical Inspiration in a Troubled Time. And the two main pieces on the program were a piece by Brahms called Nenya, and this concerns a lament for a painter who had died, whose work Brahms admired a great deal. And then the other piece was called The Mass in Time of War by Haydn, and I thought it would be a nice pairing with the lament by Brahms, because in the Brahms work there's an emphasis on an individual who is departed, and then the Haydn Mass, being a setting of the Catholic Mass, is a little more universal in scope. Behind Nenya is very interesting. There's a painter named Anselm Feuerbach who was a great classicist. He used classic architecture and classic themes in his work. And Brahms, who was known as a great musical classicist, admired Feuerbach's work a great deal. And he set to music a poem by Friedrich Schiller. And everybody knows Schiller as the poet for Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. He's the guy that wrote the Ode to Joy. But he also wrote this poem called Nenya, which is the Greek word for lament. And it begins with a beautiful and poignant line in German, Auch das Schöne muss sterben, even the beautiful must die. And of course, it's a very self-evident thought, but it's just beautifully set with this incredible melody that sort of grows out of a beautiful introduction and begins in the sopranos, and then the rest of the chorus takes it up, and it's really breathtaking. Was really a piece that struck me as particularly poignant and relevant to September 11th. My wife and I were at Ground Zero a few weeks ago, and there is a line at the end of the poem, which Brahms does his best to really set apart and emphasize a lot. And the line is, Auch ein Klaglied zu sein im Mund der Geliebten ist herrlich. Even to be a lament in the mouth of the beloved is splendid. And that really struck me, particularly as we walked around Ground Zero and saw all of these incredible tributes and sort of makeshift memorials that were just everywhere in virtually every block surrounding Ground Zero. And it struck me that there were so many laments and so many mouths of so many beloved connected with the destruction and the horror of that day, that Brahms reminds us how important it is to be remembered. all we're left with is the ability to remember and to honor and to memorialize them, and this music does it beautifully. The story behind the Haydn Mass in Time of War, or In Tempore Belli is what he calls it, is also nicknamed the Paukenmesse, which means the timpani mass. It was written in 1796, and Napoleon was in the hills outside Vienna, and in fact, Haydn and his fellow Viennese citizens could hear the rumbling of cannons in the distance. And in the last movement of this mass, the text is Agnus Dei, qui tollis peccata mundi, miserere nobis, Lamb of God, who takes away the sins of the world, have mercy on us. And Haydn does an extraordinary thing, something that was really unprecedented in music before this piece, in that he gives a solo to the timpani. And the timpani sort of rumbles this very faint, very ominous rumbling on the drum, which indicates and sort of depicts very vividly the rumbling of the cannons in the distance. So Haydn's public certainly understood what those timpani rolls meant, and they certainly were fearful in the way that many of us are fearful now, because we don't quite know what's coming next, we don't quite know what's going to happen. And it seemed to us particularly significant that Haydn and his contemporaries were feeling quite the same way. One of the great things about the Musa in Tempore Belli is the way it ends. Because even though there is a great deal of uneasiness and anguish and fear that's quite evident in this music, it ends with a very, very joyous declamation of Dona Nobis Pacem, grant us peace. And I think all of us are determined that the scourge of terrorism will end one way or the other. And we're all doing whatever we can to see that that happens. And I think we are determined and generally optimistic that there is a way of obtaining peace and there is a way of ridding the world of people who are perpetrating these acts and moving on in a peaceful way. To our concert on the 4th of November was really quite tremendous. I think people did want to gather together and listening to music. And, of course, singing has played a very key and central role in many of our reactions and responses to September 11th. I mean, we witnessed members of Congress singing God Bless America on the night of the attack. We witnessed at sporting events and at other public gatherings people giving expression of their patriotism. So singing has always played a real key role in expressing people's emotions about how they feel about their country. And so choral singing, of course, has been right in the middle of that. We began the program with a setting of the word Alleluia by Randall Thompson. And Thompson wrote this as a piece to be sung at the beginning of the Berkshire Music Center's season every summer up at Tanglewood. But the text of it, of course, is just this one simple word, Alleluia. And that is a universal word. It's the same word in English as it is in Swahili, as it is in Japanese, as it is in French. There is no translation, if you will, of the word Alleluia. And we found that to be a very comforting, very peaceful way to begin the program. We followed that by a moment of silence for the victims of September 11th. And really right at that moment, I think we were all brought together in a very unique and powerful way.
Tom Hall is the musical director of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society. His season-opening concert premiered on November 4th. You can find out more about that concert and the upcoming season of the Baltimore Choral Arts Society by going to our website at wbur.org and clicking on Special Coverage.